720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch today with you till 1 o'clock when we turn things over to King John. Lots to do on the show today, my friends, but thank you for spending part of your Saturday with us. I am most grateful to you. I hope you are enjoying the lovely, pretty, warm weather while we have it. Looks like some storms moving into the area, so we are going to be keeping you updated on all that good stuff. But like I said, lots to do on the Business Lunch today, so let's get right to it. We're going to be talking in a little bit about the 48-Hour Film Project, which is a very cool thing coming up in Chicago. You're going to want to hear all about that. And we're going to talk about the Top Tech 50 Leaders. There's a list from Crain's Chicago that's just come out. So we're going to be talking about who's on that and the projects they're leading and all that good stuff. And the end of an era. We're going to be talking about that. But first, let us talk about a very interesting story that was in the New York Times recently. Amy Heimerl joins us. She's the author of Detroit Hustle, a memoir of love, life, and home. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you could join us. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, there's a piece that you wrote in the New York Times that I think is so very interesting, and it's taking a look at why family businesses often do not make it to the second generation. When people think they're going to pass a business on to their kids, sometimes the kids just don't want it. And there's an interesting number that's in that, and that is 30% of businesses do not make it to the next generation. And so tell us about that a little bit, about what's involved with that. I'm sure there's, you know, family stuff is fraught, so I'm sure there's a lot of emotional stuff there.
It certainly is. I actually come from family business, so this is a story that's near and dear to my heart. The statistic is 30% of family-owned businesses don't make it through the second generation. So they may pass to the children, but don't go any further. And that's for a number of reasons. You know, communication is hard. There's not good succession planning. Sometimes it's that the kids don't want the business. Sometimes it's that the kids aren't well trained. You know, sometimes it's a dispute between the generations where the kids feel like they're ready to sort of run with it and the parents like won't let go of it. So there's a lot of reasons why that can happen. But family business really is sort of one of the foundations of small business in America. So it's an issue that more than 3 million businesses face right now.
And so that number includes both the second generations that take the family business and for whatever reason it does not succeed, and also when that next generation takes the, or just doesn't want to take the business for one reason or another.
Right.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So what is it with that, what's the secret of the 70% then that goes on to pass that business successfully to their children?
So the experts I talked to and all the small businesses said that it's a couple of things. One is learning how to communicate. That is fundamental, that it's much more difficult than just a traditional business relationship because sometimes you have to be parent and CEO, and that can cause difficulties. So they're actually a specialty. One of the things I learned but didn't get to talk about in the article is that there's a specialty in therapy that actually just deals with the family dynamics and communication in family businesses like this, and that's critical. The other thing that can really help is actually a good succession plan so that everybody knows what the roles are going to be, when you might take over, when the parents might meet. But I think it really all comes down to good sharing of information. And my family, we recently had to sell off the family business, and one of the reasons was because my parents divorced. And with that wasn't going to pass on to my brother. They didn't know how to continue. And a lot of it was sort of bad communication in my family. You know, all of them would tell you. And so as I talked to, you know, Natalie Sexton at Natalie's Orchard Island Juices, she told me, hey, it's really hard to talk to my mom sometimes. I feel like I have a CEO, but we're having to learn to do that because I'm so committed to taking this, you know, company even larger, even further globally, and being, you know, in the lead in the next 10 years.
I can only imagine, you know, that conversation has got to be tricky either way. Either telling, you know, the parents, hey, I don't want to take the wheel on the family business, or hey, we need to work out, you know, we need to work out our stuff to make this succession plan.
Absolutely.
Or I'm trying and I don't know that it's working. I think any of those conversations would be really fraught.
Absolutely. One of the things that has sort of changed over time is we're seeing families pass it on more to their daughters and their sons. That's becoming a trend that they're seeing as families become sort of less hierarchical about who was born first, but who has been more ready. And experts are seeing more women wanting to take on the reins of the family business. But the other thing is education. So in the past, you know, oftentimes whichever child was taking on the business would just start getting trained as a kid, and then as they sort of exited high school, they would probably go straight into the business. Now more family businesses are saying, kid, I want you to go to college, and then maybe I want you to work outside of the family business for a few years. Take that knowledge and that sort of learning of how to communicate and what a real workplace can be like and bring it back. If we're successful enough that I can hire good people around me until you come back, we'll be stronger. And so experts are seeing a lot more of that and thinking that that is actually going to create some health for the family business, and we may start to see that 30% figure change.
That would be very interesting. I also wonder, too, you know, looking at this and imagining these scenarios, if what you just described of this recent shift to send the kids to college first and then come back and slowly work your way into the business rather than just start early at, you know, as soon as you're old enough to work, learning mm-hmm. how to run this. I wonder if that is changing the way kids are coming back to the business once they, you know, having that different perspective of working at an outside company and going to college as opposed to just living and breathing the company, you know, the family business from an early age.
I would think that. So the Groth Vineyards in Napa, I think, would be a good example of that. So Suzanne Groth, the daughter, did not want to be in the family business, you know, went to college, was living in San Francisco in hospitality, and decided she wanted to come back. And her dad actually wouldn't let her in. He said, no, you need to go get some experience and learn, you know, learn the trade a little bit before, you know, I'm going to let you in because you don't have the skills yet. And so she did that and then came back as sort of a sales exec, and eventually wound up being the boss of the person who was her first boss in the company and is sort of on the track to become the next CEO. But she would say that having that experience outside gave her an entirely different perspective, not just on how the industry runs, but on good communication and what's expected as a norm in a workplace versus if all you know is your relationship with mom and dad, and then you take that into the workplace, you sort of maybe never understand what is good communication, what are good roles, how to learn to, speak for yourself, but also know that there's sort of a respect and hierarchy that has to go. So people are really sort of seeing that.
Right. And sometimes, you know, putting the hammer down at work means it's going to be a really awkward Thanksgiving table.
Oh, I've sat through so many awkward Thanksgiving tables with my family.
I can only imagine. All right. My friends, everybody, check this book out. It is called Detroit Hustle, A Memoir of Love, Life, and Home. But also definitely check out this story in the New York Times written by Amy Heimerl. It's very, very interesting. Taking a look at what that means when you pass a business to your kids or when the kids don't want the business that you pass along. It is a really, really interesting, very thought-provoking piece about business and family dynamics. Amy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we have so much left to do. We are going to be talking about the end of an era in the manufacturing world. I'll let you know what that means here in just a second. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Thrilled and grateful to you for spending part of your Saturday with us. My friends, it is the end of an era in the manufacturing world and somewhat in the media world. And that is because the very last VCR has been made. So we are bidding farewell to VCRs. And joining us now on the program is Jacob Brogan, who is a technology and culture writer at Slate. Jacob, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much.
Thanks for being with us. Well, the VCR has come to an end, but it is really a lot more complicated than we think of as just not manufacturing it anymore, because it really does have some ramifications, especially in other parts of the world. So talk us through this, give us an overview of the big picture here of the end of the era of the VCR.
Sure. So the VCR, the companies that created it actually stopped, is my understanding. I think almost a decade ago, companies that first created the system. But at that point already, it was introduced in 1976. It had been around for 30 years or so. And it has lived this really astonishing afterlife. If it's dead now, it's still sort of undead in some ways, because the VCR sets that we still have around have an expected shelf life of something like 50 years, which is one of the things I was surprised to learn when finding out about the sort of end of this format this week. So there are people all over the world who are still using VCRs, who are still using video cassettes, and still getting their media consumption through them. But I think what's happening here is really just that the sort of parts that go into creating the machines aren't available anymore, is my understanding of it. And therefore, it's just not possible to go on making them in a way that was economically feasible for Funai Electric. That's what the reporting has suggested.
I think that is so interesting. When I read that in your story at Slate.com, I could not believe that the shelf life of a VHS tape is 50 years as opposed to 25 years for a DVD. That seems...
astonishing.
It really is. I know that, you know, because tapes get eaten, you know, and they fall apart and tape goes everywhere. You know, we see them in alleys and we see them, you know, trashed like that. But it seems like the DVD would be so much sturdier. But I'm also surprised that the VCR manufacturing process lasted 40 years because, you know, I figured it would go away once we started seeing Blockbuster videos kind of go away. And we just don't see video rental places anymore. We're all about the Netflix and the DVDs and all that. And so honestly, I'm surprised that it's still going. But I think the way you broke it down in this piece in Slate, it's very interesting how popular it still is in other parts of the world. But then immediately I shift to thinking about the DVD because so much of what we're doing now is streaming. Mm-hmm. Are we expected to have are we going to have a much shorter life of the DVD player just because we've moved to digital files for our media consumption?
You know, I suspect that we might. You know, if it does stick around, it may be because it's a lot easier to hold on to a DVD. It takes up a lot less space in your house. But, you know, think about CDs. I don't have any left in my life, and I used to have hundreds, I think. And I suspect that the DVD will go the way of the CD relatively soon, in large part because we have, as you suggest, so much of our other media consumption through streaming platforms and such. But part of what's so astonishing about the VHS is that it really taught us how to consume media in that way, how to expect that our media would be available on demand. And part of its legacy may be a product of the way that it's so clearly linked in a way that DVD is not quite so organically, to the idea that we can watch what we want when we want it, as I think the Sony put it when they were first introducing some of these formats.
That is very interesting to think of the VHS tape being the precursor to on demand in the way we think of now, because we think of that as being so new culturally. We think of we almost are critical about the cultural moment we're in of, oh, people just want things so immediately. But in fact, that's kind of how it's been for a while. We've had that training already. That's sort of been a moment that we're in a little bit. Well, I think it's very interesting. And also there's still a lot of services where people, you know, transfer VHS tapes to DVD of like family videos and, you know, kind of stuff like that. So what do we think is going to happen? I mean, do people need to quickly transfer all their VHS files if they haven't done so? Or, you know, do you think there's going to be a sudden mad dash for people to change those files over to a digital format or something like that?
You know, I don't think so. I think that if anything, I suspect that the end of the sort of formal production of VCRs is going to really up the number of those services, the availability of those kind of platforms. And, you know, again, what we did learn here is that when properly stored, VHS tape can last a very long time. So I don't think you need to panic about old media, but it is worth thinking about how to back it up, save it, and preserve it, of course.
And how to play it. We may not be able to play it. Right?
Right, yeah.
Well,
another thing that was important about the VCR that Caitlin Benson Alice, the academic who was looking for this piece, pointed out that VCRs are most of them pretty easy to repair, especially the older, more mechanical models. You can really rebuild one if you need to and fix it. So the machines that we have around will probably last for a while. So it's really important for you to be able to watch things on a VCR. You'll be able to find a VCR, I think.
You know,
to buy a new one.
Right. What comes to mind here, though, is, you know, I've long said that in the publishing world should look to the music world to learn how to navigate digital disruption, because it seems like things happen in the music world about a year and a half or 2 years before they happen in publishing. And this reminds me of that, of how at one point music kind of pulled back again. And I think we're still in that moment where suddenly vinyl was very cool and special and powerful. And then, you know, in publishing moved to the ebook file, suddenly the, you know, very carefully, beautifully hand-bound editions of things became cool again. So I wonder if ever there will be a time where we'll see kind of a special fancy VHS version of something as we get so used to having digital files that we stream on demand.
It's possible that we will, although as Professor Benson Allett would point out, and as she does, I think, in the article, the interview, VHS it's not a high fidelity format, unlike like vinyl, where you can get this really rich quality of sound, unlike a beautifully bound book, where you have that really pleasurable experience of holding it, of turning the pages, of feeling paper between your fingers. VHS doesn't really have that effect, and if anything, its appeal is a nostalgic appeal. It's an appeal to the way things felt a little grainy or a little scratchier when we were younger. And I think you can see a version of that. You might see it in something like the show that's actually on Netflix right now, Stranger Things, which has a sort of older school VHS aesthetic at certain moments to it and borrows from some of the kind of feel of watching things on old cassettes, but is, of course, only available on this very new digital streaming platform.
It'll be interesting to see if maybe there's a VHS grainy quality filter that Snapchat or Instagram or something releases for us just for nostalgia purposes. That would be interesting and fun for Gen Xers like me anyway to have a little nostalgia. Okay. Jacob Brogan, thanks so much for being with us today. Everybody head to Slate and check out this story. It is really interesting. It's called RIP to the VCR. So thanks for being with us today, Jacob.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news, and we'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and spending part of your Saturday with us. We are most grateful for your time. My friends, we have a very special guest in studio. I'm very, very excited to introduce to you Jerry Vassalatos. He is from the 48-Hour Film Project. You may remember him because he was on this show last year. There is a very, very cool event that happens every year in Chicago. Last year, I got involved with it. I was one of the judges of this very cool contest in which filmmakers make a film in 48 hours. And that sounds like, sure, hit play on a camera and shoot some video and roll with it. But it was mind-blowingly cool and so creative and so interesting what people came back with. But this year, this event is already very, very cool is going to be even bigger and more exciting. And so Jerry is here to tell us all about that. Welcome back to the show, Jerry.
Thank you for having me again. It's a pleasure to see you.
I know. It's been a year.
I know. It's been a year.
And I'm
very grateful you'll be back judging again this year.
I can't wait.
It's really exciting.
I had so much fun last year.
We are going to be at the Music Box Theater this year, which is a bigger venue than last year. We had a great venue last year, but we actually had to turn people away, which we don't want to do.
It was crowded.
Yeah,
it was really crowded.
We had, the Music Box has graciously partnered with us this year, and they have a 700-seat theater.
And a beautiful theater, that cool Art Deco, so pretty.
Yeah. So the filmmaking competition weekend actually takes place Friday, August 26th through Sunday the 28th. And in that filmmaking weekend, participating teams will come to our kickoff. They will draw a genre from a hat. Could be drama, could be musical, could be Western, whatever. And they are committed to making a 7 to 8 minute movie of that genre and turn it in by 6 o'clock on Sunday. All teams are also given elements that include a line of dialogue, a character name, a character profession, and a prop. Those same elements need to be worked into everybody's film, even though they've got different genres. So they turn in their films at 6 o'clock on Sunday. We have the judges look over them. We then screen them at the Music Box Theater September 11th and 12th. And then on September 15th, we have the awards screening where our judges' selections end up screening, and we give out awards to the filmmakers. We have a very special event coming up next Sunday, July 31st, which is our filmmaker mixer. And what this is, it's kind of a kickoff to get participating teams out or people who are looking to join teams or form their own teams in preparation for the August filmmaking weekend. And we do this a month in advance because you really do need to line up your crew, your resources well ahead of time so that when you come to the Friday kickoff, you've got enough in your bag of tricks that when you're given your genre and your elements, you can like just go to the races. I always tell filmmakers, line up resources. If you know someone who's got a cool saloon, even if you don't end up using it, line up locations ahead of time, because Friday night you get your genre, you're not going to be able to make phone calls and get a location for the weekend.
That could take you the whole weekend, at least.
At least. I mean, yeah. Location scouts and location managers look weeks for TV shows or, you know, or professional movies.
Well, I thought it was interesting. Last year at the end, there was a little panel discussion with the filmmakers that I thought was really interesting because that came up a lot.
Yeah.
The people that had done this a few years in a row and were kind of pros at it, that's what they said too. They said it's really important. Line up a location or two, even maybe some actors you know you want to work with. You know, get some costumes worked out. Get some as much as you can in advance so that you don't lose a lot of time with planning once you get that genre and that line of dialogue and that character name and those things.
I try to line up resources for our filmmakers also in advance. We've got this great casting service working with us, Compass Casting, and they are able to, Sarah over at Compass Casting, she has SAG actors that are available, and we are able to work waivers with SAG, so filmmaking teams can have professionally trained actors. I mean, it's great if you pull your friends together, but it gives production value to your film if you've got trained actors. I always tell filmmakers, as easy as it is to get your camera and go shoot a short story in your backyard, that, unfortunately, is too much of the norm with some 48-hour film projects. Give yourself good production values. Line up locations. Get professionally trained actors. See if you can tap into people who work on shows in Chicago. And even if it is just your own group of friends. We have people participating from their newbies or their professional filmmakers. So it's really open to anybody who wants to participate.
And so last year, the winners were on this station within a week or so, and they were on WCIU TV the next morning. And so this year, what is involved if you win this festival, if you win the big prize, what do the winners get this year?
So what happens in Chicago is the best film ends up, the winner of the best film in Chicago, they get the best film accolades. They also get... they will be screened at Filmapalooza 2017, which is the official 48-hour film project awards weekend, which screens all of the national winners in the U.S.
And how many are there? How many different?
Oh, most major cities in every state. Yeah, I mean, this is the largest timed filmmaking competition worldwide. So city winners go on to compete nationally at Filmapalooza. A trophy is then presented to them at Filmapalooza. Local winners also receive Movie Magic Screenwriter Software 6, which is a $250 value, and we're going to be announcing some other prizes as we acquire them with sponsorship. Potentially, if you win at Filmapalooza and you go on to compete internationally, you have the possibility of screening at the Cannes Film Festival in 2017.
Not
which is
too
always,
shabby.
Yeah, it's
That's
cool
a big deal.
If you get that far. One of our winners from last year, as a result of the accolades he got from this award, this is a rite of passage for filmmakers, and it's great for your reels, too. If you want to work professionally, he went on to get a gig in videography, Derek Souders, in Major League Baseball. And, you know, this, along with a lot of his other work, you know, his winning entry, along with a lot of other things that he had done, helped get him some attention. So if you're starting out, participate. If you've done it before, participate. It's a lot of fun to get your friends together. I've participated in 6 of these as a filmmaker until I kind of retired from it.
Now you run the show.
Yeah, then I got asked to produce it, and I was like, this is great, because I really want to provide an experience for the filmmakers that I would enjoy as a filmmaker, having participated and adding some things that I felt could have been a little bit improved on. And our response last year from our filmmakers was terrific. My focus is to really spread the word, not only to recruit new filmmakers to participate, but to really encourage audiences from across Chicago to come to the Music Box in September and see the work of these emerging filmmakers. Because, you know, it's cool to have your family and friends come to the screening, but it's even cooler when people who don't know your work discover it, which is why we're really on a push to get more audiences aware of the screenings that we're going to have in September at the Music Box Theater, which is September 11th, 12th, and the 15th.
11th, 12th, and 15th. Music Box is such a great venue, everybody. Definitely go check that out.
Yeah.
So you have the Filmmaker Mixer, July 31st, coming
and that's
up.
And that's at the Music Box Lounge, which is right next to the Music Box Theater, and that's at 3733 North Southport Avenue. So if you want to join a team or form a team or register, next Sunday night, the 31st, from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., the Music Box Lounge.
And where can people go online if they're thinking of registering or finding out more?
Sure. Go to 48hourfilm.com, the number's 48hourfilm.com / Chicago-Illinois. Even if you just go to the 48hourfilm.com website, you can find the Chicago City on that main page. Scroll through the cities, find Chicago. It's got all the information on the filmmaker mixer, registration deadlines. There's an early bird deadline for people who register before August 1st. They get a deal on the registration. After that, it goes up a little bit. It's got information on the mixer, the competition dates, as well as the screening dates. So if you're thinking about doing it, visit the page and everything's there for you to take a look at. 48hourfilm.com/Chicago-Illinois.
It's so fun. IL. It's so fun.
Yeah.
And really, if you're... when we think about these kind of competitions, we psych ourselves out. There are so many different levels that it is all about the end result. No one's looking at your resume.
No.
You know, some people do it for fun. Some people really are trying to get an early start in a film career, but there's a lot of different ages. There's a lot of different levels. I thought it was really, really neat to just see the different places all the filmmakers were coming from into the project last year.
The most important thing is to have fun doing it. If you get a group of friends who you've worked with before, and you get along with, you'll have a great weekend doing it. It's really very, very, and to challenge yourselves doing it too and have something to show for it that screens in a beautiful, beautiful venue like the Music Box is tremendously rewarding.
And it sets the bar a little bit differently for future projects, because then you're like, okay, I did this much in 48 hours.
Yeah,
well, I don't need a 5-month production schedule.
Exactly. Well, if you can tell people, you made a high quality 7 to 8 minute movie in 48 hours, you're ready to work on major work, because it really is it's a crash course. I mean, you really have to know your stuff, manage logistics when you go into it. But it gives you, if you've done it before, if you're working with other people who've done it on your team, it rounds you out really well if you want to do it and move on to doing it more professionally.
And if you're just a fan of watching films, it is really fun.
Yeah.
It's a variety of different genres. It's really, really fun. There's great, great enthusiasm in the audience that weekend of the screenings. People are excited to see their work up on a big screen and their friends. It's great.
Can you imagine somebody animating a 7 to 8 minute movie in 48 hours? Our filmmakers do it. Animated movies. I'm just like, I wouldn't even know where to start. Or for the teams that draw what I think is like, you know, the most challenging genre, musical. Luckily, hopefully you'll have somebody who knows music or composes music or writes music on your team. But I've seen teams turn in musicals that were like, how did you do these lyrics and put this music together on a weekend? It's phenomenal. It's really exciting to see what these very creative filmmakers can pull off in 48 hours and share, you know, with the audiences, hopefully coming in from the city of Chicago.
It'll be really exciting. Well, I will be there again. I'm one of the judges this year, so I will
be excited about that.
Cool. I can't wait. I had so much fun last year. I loved watching all the different films, and so I will be at the Filmmaker Mixer on the 31st.
I'm glad you're going to be able to join us.
I hope lots of other people can join us too, but we hope to see you all at the screenings September 11th, 12th, and 15th, and then the awards and all that good stuff. It's a really fun weekend.
Yeah.
My friends, hope you check it out. Again, give us that website one more time.
48hourfilm.com/Chicago-IL, or just look for Chicago on the front 48hourfilm.com webpage.
There you go.
And if you want to look for us, we're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Easy places to find and connect and keep up with everything going on. Jerry Vasilatos, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy. It's good to see you again.
All right, my friends. We'll be right back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us, my friends. Hope you're enjoying the sunshine while it lasts. Looks like we may have some stormy weather coming our way, but we'll keep you updated on all that good stuff. Enjoy it while you can. My friends, there is a very important list out, and that is the Tech 50 list from Cranes. They do a list every year of the 50 tech leaders here in Chicago. And joining us to talk about that is John Pletz from Cranes Chicago. Hi, John. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks for being with us today. So talk to us about this list and what does it look like this year and how is it different from past years?
Well, it changes every year. So we kick out about 90% of the name to keep it fresh. And there's a lot of people at Chicago Tech, more than just 50. And so it allows us to sort of highlight more and more people every year. But we took a look at some areas that are particularly hot in tech right now. Whether it's the Internet of Things or big data, smart artificial intelligence, some of the other things, some of the areas that are really starting to emerge and attract a lot of interest and investment.
Well, you know, I noticed, speaking of so many people in Chicago, I was looking at Twitter this morning, and I noticed a tweet to you from J.B. Pritzker, who's on the list, who said that Chicago has gotten too big for just 50. How about next year, 150? What do you think about that?
I think it's a lot of work. But he's right that there are more and more people. And that list, you know, we sort of joked about it. It started out with 25. And then we moved it to 50, and I think the first time we weren't even thinking we would do it again, and now we do it every year, and like I said, we change out most of those names on purpose, part to keep it fresh, part because there's a lot of people emerging in tech doing great things. You've got a lot more companies getting started, and it really reflects that just the tech community in Chicago is getting a lot healthier and a lot bigger.
Definitely. And if you had to categorize or characterize, rather, the tech community in Chicago, how would you describe it? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of biotech that we do here that we don't see as much elsewhere. What is it that we do that really makes it the Chicago tech community?
Well, there's a couple of things going on there. One, we do a lot. So there are a lot of areas, everything from, as you mentioned, things like biotech, health tech, to traditional software. There's a lot of internet, there's a lot of e-commerce companies, that sort of thing. But it's really diverse, and sometimes that gives people from outside of Chicago a little bit of a hard time figuring out what it is to do here. But you really do have a very broad tech community, and I think that's probably a real asset for Chicago. But some of the things I think that we do very, very well are the sort of technology that is valuable that companies use to run businesses, but they aren't consumers, so they're not very visible. But when you sort of peel it back, those end up being some really, really valuable, strong companies. You get companies like Braintree, like CleverSafe, like Fieldglass that have been very successful over the years, but they're not in consumer industries. But I think that's really the strength of Chicago Tech.
Yeah, definitely. And if you were to look in your crystal ball and just because you know the tech community so well here in Chicago, and you were to guess about what this list might look like next year, what predictions might you have in terms of what trends you might see represented and leadership styles and types of companies might be on there?
I think you're going to see a lot more with big data, with data analytics. That's sort of the key for a lot of businesses. It's not easy, but it plays to a lot of strengths that Chicago has. We've long had really good sources of data scientists from the university. It's used and relied upon by many different companies in many different industries in Chicago. Because you have so many large companies here that rely on that, it gives Chicago a base of talent that is stronger than a lot of other places. So I think that's the sort of thing you're going to see. I think you're going to see more big data, more analytics. I think as, you know, things like
sounds like we're losing you a little bit. I think you got into a tricky cell zone there.
Oh, sorry about that.
Oh, there you go. You're back.
So those are the things I think you're going to see. I think you're going to see a lot of AI, artificial intelligence. You're going to see some machine learning. But you're going to see continued strength in data analytics, whether that's things like what you're seeing at the university level with research, like what's going on over at the University of Chicago or Northwestern, as well as private companies. I think you're just going to see more of that for the next 5 or 10 years.
Definitely. I mean, I've talked to some people from University of Chicago before on this program about particularly the health tech, biotech stuff that's going on there, and it's really, really fascinating. So I have very high hopes for the tech community in Chicago. I think there's a lot we still have yet to do, and there's a lot we're doing now. So very, very exciting. Thanks for sharing with us about this list. Everybody head over to Crain's Chicago, go to chicagobusiness.com, and look at this list of the 50 tech leaders in Chicago. Check out what they're doing. Remember their names, because they're big, important players right now in the tech world in Chicago. All right. Thanks very much for being with us, John Pletz.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You bet. All right, my friends, bye. We're going to take a little break, and then we're going to turn you over to King John here in just a bit. So stick around for that on 720 WGN.